there and welcome to Blind Like Me for this week. Let me turn this watch off so it won't be constantly counting the time as we go along. How are you, sir? Max Robinson, how's everything?
I'm just fine, Phil. How are you today?
Well, I'm good. It's kind of rainy and nasty here, but I'm inside, so what the hell do I care?
Well, the low here this morning was 9 degrees. It's 18 right now with a wind chill of about 10.
Where are you?
Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Bowling Green. I didn't realize it got that cold in Kentucky.
Yeah, well, I mean, the rest of the country is zero, but we're warm compared to them.
I just talked to a fellow in New York that said he was in single digits, was all day yesterday, and I think plans on being the same way today, so.
Yeah, all through New York and Pennsylvania, those people on the Blind Like Me list have been reporting temperatures around zero every time.
Yeah, those folks, we have an inordinate amount of folks in Pennsylvania on that list. I don't know what the deal is. They talked about having some kind of little Pennsylvania reunion.
Pennsylvania get-together.
Yeah, I told them that I would come. Bowling Green, Kentucky, the state that gave us bluegrass music.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm working on an album now with a song in it that I wrote called The Ballad of Lester and Earl.
Earl Scruggs.
Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs.
Uh-huh,
and
yeah.
No one's done any music about them. Of course, Bill Monroe started it all, but they're about as famous as he is. I mean, if you watch old-time TV, everybody runs the Beverly Hillbillies.
Of course, Music City is just about 50 miles down I-65 from here.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So I guess you've been many times?
Been down there. We have a relative. My wife's sister lives down there.
In Nashville?
Yeah.
Never
been to the Grand Ole Opry, though.
Never have been?
No.
Well, the Grand Ole Opry is a dying thing.
I'm afraid it is. I listen to it on the radio sometimes.
I do, too.
Poor old little Jimmy Dickens. He just ought to quit. He really can't sing anymore.
He's still there, though.
Yeah.
Singing
all the same old jokes.
And Bird of Paradise, Fly Up Your Nose.
Yeah.
Singing all those old tunes. And they have, I think I heard Vince Gill on there the other night. They have some new performers. But 5 years from now, there won't be. I'm afraid of Grand Ole Opry as we know it. There was a big. I don't know if you follow this kind of thing, but there was a big deal. WSM was gonna cease carrying the Grand Ole Opry. This has been about a year ago, and
they were gonna change music formats altogether.
Well, they were going to. I think they were gonna be sports talk.
And they're working in that direction. They've taken up a contract with NASCAR. They're gonna broadcast NASCAR, and they do a lot of Vanderbilt sports and so forth. So they're working in that direction gradually. They're gonna sneak it in on people. They're not gonna do it all of a sudden.
Well, what people don't realize about radio is it is not listener driven. It is dollar driven, like any other business in the world. And if they aren't making the amount of dollars they think they could make, if they think they could do better doing something else, that's what they're gonna do. They don't care whether you like it or anybody else likes it. It's just radio.
Yeah.
Radio been very, very hard on me, I'll tell you that. Okay, Bowling Green, Kentucky. Are you a total?
No, I'm a high partial. No, I don't know what you call a high partial. I'm a sort of intermediate partial. I've got 20 over 800.
20 over 800. Yeah, well,
that's not very much, but I've got some glasses. I was very fortunate at a very young age to meet up with some doctors who were pioneers in the area of low vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two sets of glasses that I've had since I was literally a teenager. One pair is suitable for working, and they're about, I guess, a 15 or something like that, 15 power.
Uh-huh.
And there's another pair that's about a 25 power, I think, something like that, that I can use to read print. With my nose on the page.
But you still have enough vision to read print.
Ink, yeah. I get ink stains on the end of my nose.
Well, that's all right. That's great that you've got that. That can be at times, I'm sure, a great advantage over us poor blind people who can't read print. However, now did you start out like this, or how did you lose your eyes?
Okay, I was born with cataracts.
Uh-huh.
And I was born in right at the end of 1939, my birthday is December 22nd, so I was almost a Christmas present. But cataracts weren't, cataracts aren't a big deal these days.
Yeah,
they were then.
Oh, sure.
And only thing they could do was a process called needling. I really am not sure what that entails.
But it sounds painful to me.
Well, I was only 6 months old when I had my first operation, so I don't have any memory. I had three operations by the time I was a year and a half, and they didn't do much good.
So, but you've never seen perfect or seen,
no,
you've never been
I've,
a...
I've never had anything better than 2,400.
2,400, and you say you were born in December of 39?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you and I are pretty close to the same age. I was born October 40.
Yeah.
So you're just a few months, you're
64.
You're 64. Well, you turned 64 in December, I'll turn 64 in October. And there's not a thing I can do about it.
There sure isn't.
Just keep
all
on.
All you can do is sing that old Beatles song to your wife.
Yeah?
You know.
Which one is that?
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me? You have to pay a royalty if I do that?
No, I don't think so.
When I'm 64. You know that one.
Yeah, I've heard that. I'd forgotten about it, though. And so you're what they call a pre-war baby. You were born when the men were men and the sheep were nervous and everything was... Everything was different back then. So you began life as a partially blind child, and did your parents always asked this, they treated you pretty normal or what?
Yes, they did. We lived on a farm, and my dad ran a shop, and I later found out the shop was the main source of income for the family, really.
The farm wasn't, the shop was.
The shop was.
Yeah.
And I've hung around the shop all the time. You know, I was interested in those mechanical things. He rebuilt engines, you know, and welded broken farm equipment. And I suppose some people were pretty horrified that a blind kid running around all this machinery all the time. But I knew it was dangerous. I was used to it.
It was second nature to you when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And this is what he did. He welded and repaired. Somebody brought in something that was broken, and he would figure out how to fix it.
Yeah. He had a welder. He had an electric welding machine and acetylene welding outfit, and he had grinders for sharpening plowshares. You know, that was a big deal.
Sure. Back then it was. Yeah.
And had a drill press. He had a forge too. He could forge metal.
As in taking a piece of metal and actually making something out of it by heating it up and
heat it red hot and pound it into shape on an anvil with a hammer. You know.
But what a wonderful way for a blind person to get introduced to mechanical things. To fix stuff. I was considering myself very lucky. My daddy was a radio repairman, an amateur electrician. Back then, when you could do that kind of, when you didn't have to have a city permit, and he'd go around and wire, put in porch lights for people, and replace sockets and wire their houses and repair radios. And so I was fortunate, and I learned a lot of little electronic things. So, and your father was quick to show you stuff, I guess. Was happy to let his blind. Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had two older brothers. I was the youngest.
Uh-huh.
And the oldest one was much older. He was 19 years older than I. we weren't very close at that age. We've become close now. He's still living.
Really?
He lives down in Texas.
So he would be 83.
83, he's in a little place called Bogota. I don't know if you ever heard of that one or not.
No. What is that?
The northeast. I never can remember the bigger towns that it's near, but it's
and it's Bogota.
Bogota.
Well, I'll do some research on that. That's one I thought I'd heard all the towns in Texas. And so you were a late child. You came along. Your parents were, I guess your father was at 40-something when you were born, probably.
Yeah,
approaching.
My father was born in 1899, and my mother was born in 1901.
Really? Yeah, but older parents a lot of times are a little are more tolerant or more, understand a lot better that your blindness to you is normal way of life. So they tend to. What did they do on the? Did they do any farming at all?
In the early days they did. Matter of fact, I can remember seeing the the farm operation. You know, I always wanted to be where the action was. You know, remember they hired somebody one year to shock the oats. And I don't know how many people know what that is.
Well, I don't, so tell us.
What they used to do, excuse me, what they used to do is cut the oats when it was mature, and there was a machine called a binder that would cut it and then tie the straw, the oats and the straw into bundles, you know, the oats still on the end of the straws, on the stalk, and tie it into bundles. Actually, a machine could actually tie a knot and toss it out the back, and these bundles would lay on the ground, and then somebody would come out into the field and pick up the bundles and put them up in piles called shocks. So they would dry, and then after they dry, then you come along with another machine that you bring them in by hand to a machine called a thrashing machine.
Mm-hmm.
They pronounce it a threshing machine.
Threshing machine,
days.
Sure.
We call it a thrashing machine.
Yeah,
and bring it in by hand and toss it into this big machine that was run by a tractor power, you know, run by a pulley-form tractor, and it would run these bundles through and separate the straw from the wheat and put the straw out in a big pile and put out the wheat in the into a wagon.
Yeah.
You'd take it to town and sell it. And, of course, you had a... I don't know if you've ever heard the expression "cooking for a thrashing crew."
Yeah, really, you had to cook lots of food.
And the women would be in the house cooking all morning, and the men would be working out in the field, and it was hard work. You'd work up an appetite.
So they hired somebody to do this, and
And
you were right there with him.
And I was right there watching. You know, I had to get close to see too. So
yeah,
I was right up there with the action. And I knew to stay out of the belt. You know, I knew that was dangerous because it was just second nature, as I think you already said.
And you were a little bitty kid at this point in time.
Yeah.
That's good to learn.
Preschool, under 5 years old.
To begin to learn how things work. It's important to me. A lot of people don't care about how things work, and you do, don't you? That's important to you.
Uh huh.
And so they when you were became school age, what was their decision? Did they do?
My mother was insistent that I stay at home and not stay out of school, but be schooled in some way. And so she was way ahead of her time. She didn't she wanted me to be mainstreamed, although they didn't. She never used that word. It hadn't been coined yet.
That's right. It hadn't been.
But
no.
There was a lot of resistance. And she fought hard. Now, in the debate of mainstreaming versus residential school, I'm not sure anymore. You know that was the best thing, because if I had gone to the residential school, I would have learned Braille for one thing.
Yeah.
I never learned Braille. And I was, till computers came along, I was illiterate. Really, I couldn't read or write.
So they forced the public school there in your town to take you.
Yeah, it was a battle pretty much, and I went. That was responsible for some of our movement. We left Iowa. This was in Iowa.
Okay, you were in. We didn't touch on that. You were in Iowa at this point in time.
Yeah, the farm was located in Iowa, so I started kindergarten in Iowa and went there about half a year, and then we went to Florida. Now, they had been down to Florida before the war.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's mother lived down there, and as a matter of fact, my mother's entire extended family had moved down there.
And this was during the war. This was about 43 or 44.
Well, I started kindergarten in 45.
45. So the war was winding down.
The war was over, yeah. And so then with the tires, you know, the gas rationing lifted and you get tires and so forth. And so after all that was lifted, why, they decided to go to Florida for the winter.
Now, not because of your schooling, but they just decided that it was too cold in Iowa and they were going to move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really a move at that time. We just, you know, locked up the farm and went to Florida.
Okay.
We ended up staying the winter. Well, I think that was the plan, to stay the winter. And then we went back the next summer.
Hey, your mother may have had other ideas, though, right?
Maybe. so they put me in school in Florida and had the same resistance and the same trouble.
I'm sure.
And they put me in the first grade because they said I was too advanced. The kindergarten in Florida, the kindergarten in Iowa was way ahead of the one in Florida. I was already reading and, it was reading the Dick and Jane stories.
Yeah, because remember, this man, you can see well enough to read print limitedly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the books, the little kids' books then were big print anyway, so it was no problem. And then used a handheld magnifying glass. That was all the aid I had then. But it helped. It did the job.
Yeah.
And when I got to Florida, all they were doing in kindergarten was drawing pictures and playing, you know. And so they put me in first grade because I could already read.
Yeah.
And already do some simple arithmetic, you know. And the teacher didn't give a damn. That was her whole attitude toward me. Was
she didn't care.
Didn't give a damn. Yeah, and so
is that right?
So I, as a consequence, I didn't do anything in that grade, and I failed and repeated it. And then, but then I got jumped over into second grade when I was due to be, you know, and the teacher there was very helpful. She would write out the arithmetic problems in larger letters, you know, handwrite them in larger numbers so I could read them, and all the assignments, really. Anything she put on the board, she would put on a sheet of very large lined paper for me, and excuse me, and so then I would do the work and. I never had any problem learning, you know. I could do the work, and so I did pretty well through the second grade.
All right, let's stop there with you in the second grade.
Okay.
And take just a little quick break, and be back in just a second with more of our Blind Like Me show.
Okay.
Information you probably never need. Titillating tidbits to make you think on the blind side. Here's Mark Christie.
Tom Lay was a 1987 National Federation of the Blind scholarship winner, and he has been an active member of the organization and a leader of the Louisiana affiliate and the student division. He grew up as a sighted kid and always wanted to be a football player. At least he wanted this career until he was 10 or so. Due to diabetes, he started to become blind during his last year of high school. It took about 10 months to go from having 20/20 vision to being totally blind. After high school, he got some training in the skills of blindness. In Arkansas, he was taught how to use a short cane and learned to read Braille, and then he came back to Louisiana and enrolled in college. I was very lucky, he says, because my university is in the town of Ruston. At about that time, the Louisiana Center for the Blind was opening. The director of the center found me, took me to the state convention of the National Federation of the Blind in Louisiana. I had always enjoyed teaching, doing tutoring when I was in high school. The idea stuck with me that I'd like to be a teacher. But I had never heard of a high school math teacher who was blind. I thought it was out of the question. I wanted to be just like the high school math teachers that I'd had, and I did not want to teach at a school for the blind. Not that there's anything wrong with teaching at a blind school, but I wanted to be right in the mainstream. At the Louisiana Center, I acquired personal confidence, undoubtedly the most important characteristic of all. Until that time, I had never had it. I had seen it in other blind people, and I knew that it might be mine, maybe in the future. But because I acquired confidence at the center, I knew that I could teach. I learned that my blindness is just another part of me, as is my height or my being right-handed. Blindness is no longer something that overwhelms me or predominates my life. It is not the defining characteristic of my personality. I worked my way through the courses, and I did just fine. My first year of teaching was challenging, exciting, interesting, and fun. There were a lot of sleepless nights and hard work. Grades and papers must be turned in on time. If grades are due today, no teacher can expect to get extra time. The skills I use in the classroom are basic. My high-tech equipment consists of a slate and stylus, a tape recorder, and masking tape. Tom has the duties of a full-time teacher, including chaperoning, and he sells popcorn at the basketball games. He says recently he had a chance to talk to a physics teacher who has been teaching for a long time, but is now starting his first year as a blind teacher next fall. We all help each other. Together we can demonstrate that given training and opportunity, blind people can compete successfully in all areas of education. On the Blind Side, I'm Mark Christie.
On the Blind Side, celebrating the contribution of blind people to societal evolution.
Interesting today with Max Robinson. We've gotten you in school. We've moved you from Iowa to Florida. What a move! What a change in climate! What a change in your life! No more farm life. So you went down there, but then you had to, of course, go back and get your things and get ready to move down there. So you're in the second grade, and you actually had a helpful teacher and you could read, and she made the math problems bigger so you could see them. What a nice thing for that lady to do, because
yeah,
she got you started.
Her name was Mrs. McElway or McElroy, something like that.
Yeah.
Credit where credit is due.
And she, had it not been for her, things might not have worked out for you. You don't know.
You never know, yeah.
But she helped you get oriented and begin learning some math. So you went... You continued in. You never went to a blind school per se.
No, that's right. For the third grade, we tried going back to Iowa because there was a special school, they called it, a school for the handicapped, which was mostly for physical impairments.
Uh-huh.
And that was in Marshalltown. And. We had decided we were going to stay the winter that year.
In Iowa.
In Iowa, because of that school.
Yeah.
And a matter of fact, my mother moved off the farm. She and I moved off the farm. She got a job as a housekeeper with a woman who was confined to bed in Marshalltown. And
because that's where the school was.
That's where the school was.
Yeah.
And so we were off the farm, and... That was the year that I made my music debut, my big music debut.
And tell us about that.
The radio station in Marshalltown was KFJB.
Uh-huh.
I think it's still there with the same call letters.
KFJB, Marshalltown, Iowa.
And they had a program. Well, every station had it. Every radio station in those days of any size at all had a station band.
Sure.
And they put on live music, and every Saturday night they had the KFJB barn dance, and they started an amateur program, and I was always going around singing.
Yeah,
I'd sing along with the radio, or if there wasn't any radio on, I'd be just singing songs that I'd learned from the radio.
Yeah,
and so my mother said, took me down and entered me in this contest, and. So, you know, it was the cute little kid syndrome. You've probably been there.
Yeah, once or twice.
And you've gone up against them. Yeah, so I was the cute little kid.
They loved you.
And also I sang on key and on time. So,
you know,
I was a double threat at that time. And so I won the contest. And it wasn't just all little kids. There were adults. I went up against adults.
So it was actually a talent contest.
Yeah, uh-huh, and I won it. Now, at 8 years old.
Winning it, did that mean you got to be on the radio, or was the talent contest held on the radio?
The talent contest was held on the radio.
Oh, okay. So.
And then I got to come back the next week and do some solos.
Now, what kind of band was this? Was it a country?
Yeah, it was
country?
It was a string band.
String
band.
So it had an upright bass, probably, and no.
Yeah, I had a stand up bass and electric steel guitar. Several acoustic guitars. I think maybe they did have an electric Spanish guitar too.
And maybe a fiddle. They have a fiddle player.
Oh yeah, they had a fiddle player.
I always had a fiddle player.
They were called. Get this. It was in Marshalltown. They were called the County Marshals.
The County Marshals.
Yeah.
And this was live on the radio.
This is when you could hear live music on the radio any day of the week.
This was 1940.
This was 48.
1948. And do you remember what you sang?
Yeah, I do. I sang Zippity Doo Dah, and it was a medley. Zippity Doo Dah, and I'm looking over a four-leaf clover.
I'm looking over a five. Yeah. I know.
I still sing those songs.
I know the words to both songs.
Yeah,
That's Zippity Doo Dah. Well, that wasn't real. That's not a real country sort of a tune. I guess.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
But it went all right.
Oh my, what a wonderful day!
Yeah, uh-huh. It was very popular then. You know?
Oh yeah, I know.
Movie Song of the South was out then. You know.
I was around.
you were. Uh-huh.
I'm looking over a four leaf clover.
And that goes back to the '20s. You know that.
Yeah, it does. That's an old song, but there's always somebody back then coming out with one of those old tunes, do it kind of new style or do it.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That was always going on, and so you sang on the radio twice. Did they invite you to be a regular, or what did they?
No, I never got on as a regular, but they did. You know, as a result of winning the contest, I got to come back the next week and do some solos on the regular part of the show.
Uh-huh. This was in a big. They had a big studio
big,
there.
A big auditorium. It was put on. I don't remember the name of the auditorium. It was a big place. It seemed big to me anyway. At 5 uh-huh. years old, I think they said it seated 1,200 or something like that people.
Now by remote control, we take you to right.
Yeah,
that's what the guy
said.
It
was not the Ryman Auditorium exactly, but you know, it was. I sort of had the experience of sort of a smaller version of the Grand Ole Opry. That's really what it was.
It sure is. It's at every lots of towns had those kinds of things. They're kind of coming back. A lot of little towns in East Texas have a little Saturday night Opry. They don't. You can't hear them on the radio, but they're.
They do them locally.
Yeah, they just do them. So you did this, and were they teaching you any music? Was anybody trying to teach you how to play guitar or anything?
I started taking guitar lessons sometime around this time. And I don't remember exactly how old I was, but I think it was about that time. And of course, the teacher was one of the guys in the band.
You know? Oh, he was one of the guitar players in the band.
Yeah, they all taught on the side, you know, to earn more money.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure they didn't get paid much at all, you know.
For the opera show, I'm sure they didn't.
They did the daily show on the station, but still, I doubt if they got paid very much.
So you think they were on it like at 12:30 every day on the radio station or
that's
something?
That's right. It wasn't the noon hour.
Yeah, sure. That was the deal. They'd come on at noon probably, and they'd do some news, and they'd do the farm report.
Farm report.
Hog futures and some old guy, you know. That read very slow, and then at 12:30, live from our studios, here's,
the County Marshals.
The County Marshals, and when they were going off, they'd kind of fade out, and you hear the guy in the control room open the mic, and you could hear him bleeding through the window, you know. I loved it. That's radio. That's the kind of radio I grew up on.
Uh-huh.
I love it. And so you start taking guitar lessons then, learn those E and G and C and all the little chords that you learn.
Uh-huh.
You
know. Start out with C, G, and F, and I really couldn't hit the F at that age.
You couldn't make it barred F.
Couldn't make that bar.
And they wouldn't let you make a short F.
No, he did teach me the short F, because my fingers were just too small to make the bar.
Yeah. Yeah, but you got to learn that bar chord, or then you're stuck in open chords. You've got to know.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to know those bar chords.
You've
got to be able to. I still don't make them well, but I put them in and strum a little bit. And so you started music. You were going to public school. So your life was, and you were home with your brothers and sisters, and there were kids your age. And when the family got ice cream, well, you got ice cream.
Yeah, that's right.
That's nice. But no one thought to teach you Braille. That's amazing to me.
Oh, well, no, nobody could. Nobody knew any Braille. You'd have to know Braille to teach it.
Yeah, that's true. But you'd think that somebody would have thought, because like we've talked, Braille basic ABCs are fairly easy to learn. You know, just plain old basic. Have you learned Braille later in life, or are you still?
No, I still don't know Braille.
Still don't know Braille. Well,
I tried to learn it one time, and I had come along fairly well. I was reading grade one, pretty, you know, about as fast as you can read grade one, and I was beginning to work on. There was a level called grade one and a half, and I was work on that.
Yeah.
But then I went off to college, and I didn't have any Braille books to read. To keep it up.
That's true. Yeah.
And so we're kind of jumping ahead
Eventually the family moved to Florida.
Eventually sold the farm and moved to Florida.
And your father got another job, job.
My uncle was a building contractor, and so he worked with him.
Oh, Dad fit right in because he knew.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. he would be a natural for that.
Yeah.
But you gotta admire your mama.
She was really courageous.
Her tenacity.
She literally fought for me.
I've often thought how difficult it was for my mother to send, because I had a blind older brother, 10 years older than me, and to send those kids and me, little Phil, at 6 years old, happy little Phil, send him off to prison.
Yeah.
Basically, at 6 years old, must have been as hard on her as it was me.
Well, they in Iowa, they wanted them to send me off to Vinton.
Yeah, sure.
And Vinton was the name of the town where the blind school was, and we went and toured the place, and it looked like a prison.
Well, it was.
And it had rules like a prison.
It was a prison. Trust me.
And my mother said, "No way." She denied it in later years. But they left. We left Iowa very precipitously that year. We just packed up the car and were gone. And I think there was something going on with a court order or something.
You think they may have been trying to force them to put you in a school for the blind?
Yeah, I think so.
But she never did discuss.
She and I would go back to the farm on the weekends when I was in the school in Marshalltown. And one weekend we went home and they said, "We're going to Florida," just like that, just out of the blue. No advance planning, apparently. We just tossed everything in the car, and we were gone.
There must have been something else going on that you didn't know about. That they didn't tell you about.
Because they were kind of, my mother especially, was nervous. She was scared of something that night. I remember that night pretty vividly. You know.
Yeah.
And I've written about it on the blind like me list, even. I don't know if you saw that post or not.
I didn't. I didn't, but I've got all those messages. I've got a little archive that I keep them on. I'll go back you must have had. How old were you when this final move to Florida came?
Well, that precipitous jump was. Yeah. I was still 8 years old.
Oh, you were serious in the third grade.
Ready to turn nine.
Third grade or so.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, because I was born in December, I was I started a grade at the right age, but then I turned a year ahead, so it seemed like I was a year behind.
Well, the only thing bad about this is it ended your radio career, your musical.
Well, not really. It continued in Florida.
Oh, did it? Well, tell us about that. Tell us, get into that a little bit.
Let's see. There were still amateur contests, and in Iowa, after that first win, you know, it sort of, Mom and I both got the fever, so to speak, and she took me around to every little amateur contest, and there were lots of them in those days.
And you won a bunch of them.
I won a bunch of them, yeah. I lost a few. I won a few, lost a few. And that sort of taught me about winning and losing, too, you know.
Oh, yeah. You got to know how to be a graceful loser.
Uh-huh. And so, and these weren't on the radio. These were just local contests.
Uh-huh.
And she took me around to these. And then when we went to Florida, she started seeking them out down there. And there weren't as many in Florida, it seemed. She found some, and some of them were on the radio, and one of them was even on television in the early days of TV.
But by then, were you proficient enough with the guitar to accompany yourself?
Yeah, I started accompanying myself. That first win, I was just singing with a piano accompaniment, and the band chimed in a little bit. But by this time down in Florida, I was good enough on the guitar. I could accompany myself, and
yeah. Yeah, which...
then I was, you know, I was older by then, and the cute little kids coming along behind me were the ones that were beating me out a lot of the time.
Yeah, but that was a great experience for you. So we moved to Florida, and you went all the way through public school. Did they move around, or is this the same school?
They tried me in a school in Dunedin, Florida. That's where we live, Dunedin. It's mm-hmm. near Clearwater, near St. Petersburg.
Uh-huh.
And back in the same school where that was where the second grade teacher was good.
The third grade
teacher was only so-so. She wasn't as good. And so then they found a school that the county was running down in Clearwater called the Cripple Children's School. And she got me into that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where I went for the rest of my schooling career.
So,
except for 1 year when they closed it, I went down to St. Petersburg. That was the fifth grade to something called a sight saving class.
Yeah.
And that was the rest of my schooling career, which took me through the eighth grade.
So you met a lot of kids who had physical problems in that school,
and some mental retardation, although they don't call it that anymore.
No, they don't.
So I sort of learned how to get along with different kinds of people, if you understand what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm. But they had 12 grades there, and so you were able to...
No, I didn't go all the way. They didn't have grades all the way through high school at that school. It was only through eighth grade. And so after that, then, I was homeschooled by a correspondence course.
Uh-huh. And your mother was a teacher?
Yeah, she was the teacher.
Bless her heart.
The teacher and the reader.
And so she did most of your reading.
Yeah, she did the reading for me.
And she would test you, and you would, and so you got a diploma from a legitimate correspondence sort of a school.
Yeah. Well, I had to take the GED to make it official.
Yeah, that's all right though.
But I did. And they said down at the school board that I had passed with a higher score than anybody who'd ever taken the test before.
I'll bet you did. let's get you into college. Before we do that, let's just take a little quick break and run a little thing here and be back in just a moment with more of Blind Like Me.
Okay.
Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now with this week's Blind Site, here's Don Shaw.
Are you getting hungry, looking for something really good to eat? Something really different that you haven't fixed in a while? Well, go to cooks.com. They have a really, really large searchable database of really good recipes. Some are easy to cook, some are not so easy to fix, but most of them do really sound good. Everything from pizza to seafood to Mexican food are a really good shrimp gumbo, seafood gumbo, and everything in between. Their database is reasonably easy to search and really large. So if you're just wanting to try something new, something different, they would be worth checking out. Go to www.cooks.com and find their database archive of choices. Find you something really good to eat and go over and tell them about it on the Cooking in the Dark list. I'll give them a screen reader friendliness rating of a 7. Until next week, I'm Don Shaw. Keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
We're visiting Blind Like Me with Max Robinson, who lives in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And we've gotten you through high school, taking the GED, and it's time to go to college. What did we do then?
Okay, well, along the line, somewhere I began to get interested in electronics. I had, because of my music, I had an electric guitar and amplifiers and a tape recorder, and nobody knew how to work on a tape recorder, so Dad and I dug into it and figured out how to fix it ourselves. You know, we worked on it together.
Yeah, because Dad...
He was interested in mechanical things.
Sure.
And I was interested in about anything that worked, you know, how did it work? And so we fixed the tape recorder, and so I became interested in electronics. And matter of fact, I got a ham license in 57. They had the old novice license then.
They did.
KN4ODS.
So you were 18 then, 17, 18.
17, yeah.
And you got a ham license, and you were doing code.
I was never good at code. I'm still not good at code.
So you did some AM talk, some talk with
After I got up to the 13 words a minute, got my general class. Well, then I went over to AM and never went back.
Never went back. Never. Talking, actually, this was before sideband or anything else. It was just straight.
That's right. It was AM.
AM, you flipped the switch. The filament stayed on all the time, and you'd flip the carrier on and talk and say over. And
I just hung a modulator on my novice transmitter, and I was on AM.
And away we went.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. So you became interested in electronics.
Yeah. And Florida State Agency for the Blind got involved. Now, it's kind of interesting because it's called, I don't know if it still is, at that time it was called the Florida Council for the Blind.
Florida Council for the Blind.
Now, I don't know if they still call it that, because if they do, it must be kind of confusing, what with the Florida Council of the Blind and the Florida Council for the Blind.
Yeah.
Being two very different things.
Florida Council for the Blind was a state-run agency.
Right.
And what did they do for you?
Well, when I turned 18, they took on my case. You know, that was...
Yeah, that's the deal.
And so I went over for a whole battery, an entire day of aptitude tests over to Tampa. That was their regional headquarters, I guess. And they decided I was interested in electronics and music about equally.
We wouldn't know that.
we wouldn't know that.
We wanted to spend an entire day figuring out.
Took a whole day to figure that out.
I've been through those. Yeah.
But they said I was, my music aptitude was a little thin. I didn't have perfect pitch.
Oh.
So they said, and they pointed out that music is really a difficult living. You know, you are either a star or you starve, is what it amounts to in music, you know.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, it's kind of close to
but
that.
But that's not a bad analogy, really.
But so they felt that probably electronics was a better route to go. So they started me out with some correspondence courses from DeVry Tech. And now they've been corporate taken over a lot. They don't exist anymore as such, but that's what it was back then. Have you ever heard of them?
I never have, no.
The DeVry Technical Institute.
No, I've missed that.
I still have the breadboard I got from them.
Is that
when
right?
I was taking the class.
Mm.
And so I learned, tubes and transistors were just coming in then. They didn't have much about them in the course. It was mainly tubes and circuits and pretty strong emphasis on TV circuitry, too. And I did so well in that the council decided, my counselor decided maybe I was college material. So
now, they were basically teaching you how to repair televisions.
Yeah, that's pretty much what that was, that course was.
You were the only blind person in the course?
Well, I suppose I was, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a correspondence course.
Oh, it was a correspondence course. Okay.
Yeah.
So they wanted to teach you, because that was a big deal then. If you knew, TV repair was a big deal then. A lot of people
it was.
Made a living doing...
That was when you could actually repair a TV. You didn't just throw it away and buy a new one.
That's correct. When you fixed them.
Yeah, you fixed them. And so they... The Florida Council for the Blind decided that I was college material, so they took me in for another big battery of tests, and we went up to Gainesville for this one. I say we because there were a bunch of other blind people there, too. We all sort of converged on Gainesville.
Yeah, and took these tests.
For the University of Florida.
Yeah.
And this was in the summertime when there wasn't much going on up there. And this was a two-day battery of tests. Went up there and stayed overnight, a couple of nights.
Oh, my, they really wanted to evaluate you.
Uh-huh. And to make a long story short, I got in with a major in electrical engineering, and I got through and got out. I graduated.
So you got a degree in electrical engineering.
I got a bachelor's degree, and then I had done so well in that, I graduated with high honors. 4.82, I think, was my overall. 3.82, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
4 is the highest possible.
And yours was 3.82.
3.82. So then I went to graduate school and got a master's degree.
In electrical
engineering.
Electrical.
With a minor in astronomy.
Whoa!
And the minor in astronomy was because I was already planning for my job, my work career, because they had a radio astronomy program at the University of Florida, and I had a friend who was a part of it.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lot of long talks with him, and he figured that he could help get me on there after I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I minored in astronomy so I could get on with this radio astronomy program.
Okay, now I don't have any idea. What did they do?
Okay. Radio astronomy involves basically listening to static from the stars.
Okay.
In this case, their program was listening to static from Jupiter, from the planet Jupiter. And it puts out some pretty strong static on the HF band. You can hear it with a ham receiver if you have the right kind of antenna. If you just take a beam, basically what they had a bunch of beam antennas that were pointed up to the sky instead of out.
Yeah.
And
so this is like the SETI Institute.
Kind of, except we're not listening for anything from intelligent life. We're just listening to the natural sounds, the radio sounds that nature makes.
Why do we want to hear those?
By listening to the stuff from Jupiter, we figured out Jupiter had a strong magnetic field, and that the moons that went around Jupiter were affecting the magnetic field.
All right. But surely that's not all they do, is sit and listen to this.
Well, you don't listen to it. You
analyze it.
You analyze it. You feed it into a computer these days.
Yeah, but back then, what did you do?
Then we were recording it on regular audio tape, and that was one of the projects that I was involved with. We'd take the tape, we'd take the recording tape, but we'd have time signals on the other track. We'd use a stereo recorder.
Okay.
Record the static from Jupiter on one channel and time signals from WWV on the other channel.
Okay.
We do that in remote locations, and one was in Gainesville. They had one down in Chile. They had one in St. Petersburg, Florida, and one in they'd started out with one in Ocala, and then they kept seeding it out further. You know,
uh-huh.
And we would bring these tapes together and combine them, and it would. It was as if it was an antenna that big. In other words, from Gainesville to Ocala, which is about 20 miles, it was as if we were listening on a 20-mile big antenna.
Okay.
And
we would synchronize these tapes together.
Yeah, and that was the project that I worked on.
And we would listen to see the differences in the tapes
Right, uh-huh.
Looking
and we'd analyze it in a computer, and it gets rather involved. But basically, what it is, it's you begin to see what the source, see in quotes what the source looks like.
Uh-huh.
Is it a spot? Is it two spots? You know, what kind of a thing is it? And that was how I wound up in Bowling Green, because what they did was wherever they sent a graduate student to become a teacher,
mm-hmm.
they would build a station. And so,
or a listening post.
Yeah, a listening post.
Okay.
And so they decided to build a station here in Bowling Green because one of their graduates was head of the department at Western Kentucky University
uh-huh.
back in 68 when I came up here. And so they sent me and another fellow named Dick Flagg up here to build a station and train the students to observe and tell them, teach them basically when to turn the tape recorder on.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up applying for a job up here and staying.
And this was all the same people that you'd worked for in Florida.
Yeah. Uh huh.
And how much trouble did they have accepting a blind person to do this job?
Well, I'm told they were a little reluctant at first, but they were really nice to me. They all said, "Well, okay, we've got this man who's applied. He's well qualified. We'll hire him on.
He has the credentials. He has the degree.
Mm-hmm.
He functions like a normal person. He isn't flipping his hands or rocking or doing any blind things. He's just
never acquired any of those.
He's just a normal guy that happens to have less sight than you do. But he has one great advantage. He knows a lot about tape recorders, and he knows what you don't have to tell him what WWV is.
Right.
So it was a natural for you, really, when you think about it.
Uh-huh.
It was a natural job for the experiences that you'd had. It was a wonderful job for you.
Well, as I was coming out of college, I knew I would have a lot of trouble getting into industry.
Yeah.
As an electrical engineer, so I decided to go the academic route. Which I felt I could get into that more easily, and I knew it wouldn't pay as well, but that was the trade-off that I made with better security, and it turned out to work for me.
Well, you had the degrees, and you could always teach.
Yeah, which is what I did some of, too.
Which is what you ended up doing, how long did this job with this company last?
The radio astronomy group in Florida, I stayed there for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And I came to up here to Western, and I retired from there 2.5 years ago.
So this was your lifetime work?
Yeah, this was my lifetime work. Uh-huh.
You say you taught some? Did you teach at college level or what?
Yeah, I taught physics and electrical engineering classes, as well as I was a high-class maintenance man in some areas, and then I did some design work and building. In other words, if somebody had an experiment to do, I worked for the entire science college,
uh-huh.
all the science disciplines. And so if somebody had an experiment in biology and they needed some piece of electronics, they would come to me and tell me what they wanted to do, and I would either find something in a catalog, or if I couldn't find something, I would design it and build it.
So you managed to make the transition from our old tube-type things to transistors, to transducers, to diodes, and the things that we use now.
Yeah, to integrated circuits.
Yeah, to ICs.
Pretty much had to learn all of that on my own after I got out. Because
they weren't teaching that in 58, were they?
They were teaching mostly tubes when I came through, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like your life has been good.
Well, yes, it has. I have a sense of accomplishment now that I've retired. You know, I consider I've lived a successful life and had a successful career. And, but I'm not going to dry up and blow away by any means.
You don't sound... I would never have guessed from your voice that you're 64.
Yeah, I guess that's the singing that keeps the...
Well, it's the singing, and it's the fact that you aren't. I can tell by talking to you that you've got something going. You're not sitting around doing nothing.
Well, that's right. I'm I've been pursuing my music career. I'm all along, you know, I kept it going in the background, and I write songs, and I have a website devoted to my music.
Well, let's get into that. There's a song in your head all the time, right?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
All right, we're almost out of time. Give me your website so folks can go read about you and look at it.
I've got two websites.
All right.
One of them is www.Max's Music Place. You just take Max's Music Place, take out the apostrophe and all the spaces.
Max's Music Place. It's all one word.
It's all run together in lowercase.
.com. Max's Music Place.com, and there you will find music produced by you?
That's right. Written, performed, and produced.
Songs that you've written?
Original songs.
Are most of these basically country?
Oh, they have there's a lot of 60s folk influence in my music. I was strongly influenced, especially by Joan Baez, but the whole 60s scene.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you have a CD copy of Diamonds and Rust?
Oh, yeah.
I do, too.
I've got Diamonds and Rust.
I do, too, and about once a month I have to get it out and listen to her sing, "Well, I'll be damned."
Yeah, there comes your ghost again.
Is one of my... Jesse is...
I have a webcast show on my website. And I'm doing Silky. Now, if you remember Silky?
Yeah.
I'm doing that on this month's show.
Well, I'm going to have to go look, and we need to talk. I'm a songwriter also.
I do some
songwriting, so we need to... I've been looking for somebody to write with, because I keep two or three songs that I'm working on in my head at all times.
And I'd like to get my other website mentioned, too.
Go ahead.
I do have a lot of cross mentions on the two sites.
Okay.
The other one is Fun with Toots. I decided, now that I'm retired, I don't have to mess with these transistors anymore. They're really small and hard to work on. You know, I can go back to tubes so you can really get your fingers into those.
Fun with Tubes.
Yeah, it's all the same
all
thing.
One word.
All run together. Fun with Tubes. It's www.funwithtubes.com. Well, I've actually registered .net and .com on it, so either one will get you there.
Yeah, you have both domained.
Yeah.
Funwithtubes.com.
And I call that my antique electronics site. And it actually stirs up a lot more interest than my music site for some reason. I guess there are a lot of people doing music, but not many people doing tubes, what it amounts to.
Yeah, tubes are... And if you've got something with tubes, you can still get them. You may think you can't, but you can.
You can. Yeah.
I just ordered... I've got a couple of little Altec mics that use tubes, and I just bought two new tubes for them. In fact, I'm talking on one right now.
Oh, you've got one of those Altec condensers?
I have an Altec condenser. I have two of them. A pair of Altec condenser mics. I wouldn't take for them.
You wouldn't.
The answer to the next question is no, you can't have them. I got to go, Max. We've run out of time, but you've had a wonderful life and an interesting life, and we're going to wait a while and get back into some other things you've done a little later on.